Jim Cantillo is our guest lecturer this morning. Jim was a teaching assistant of mine for many years. He did his master's degree at Cornell on captive breeding. He was particularly interested in the programs with the peregrine falcon and the California condor. He wrote a very, very fascinating thesis, and then went on to do his doctoral dissertation on the ethics, not just of hunting, but the most difficult case, the ethics of sport hunting. That is perhaps the area that's gotten the most opposition, so he thought he would go right to the heart of the matter and write on that topic. Jim knows enormously more about these issues than I do. That's what professors like to see in their students. They like to see their graduate students quickly surpass them in knowledge. And so he's eminently qualified to talk with us on this issue today, and we'll save time also for discussion. Just one more announcement, Greg. I have your papers to hand back. Not all of them got back through the regular channels. They arrived a little late, some of them, and then Nancy was sick part of the day, the secretary, so it got a little confused, but I have them with me, and those are all available today. Jim, it's all yours.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. These guys have loaded me down with all kinds of electronic stuff, so hopefully I won't trip over that. It's an honor to be here. Professor Bear is, you know, this is the last time 407, in theory, is going to get taught, and so it's a real pleasure to be here. Just to date myself, I took this course as a student, as an undergraduate, while I was at Cornell back in 1983, so I'm on my 20-year anniversary of contact with this course, exceeded perhaps only by the good doctor. Just to let you know, I'm going to talk about a couple of case illustrations of things. I understand you guys have read a little bit of Singer and a little bit of Regan. That's really the what we're talking about. Eventually, I want to get to three topics: the rise of the so-called no-kill shelter, no-kill animal shelters. This is almost a social movement. The idea of looking for alternatives to killing animals, mainly pets and cats and dogs. The second big area I want to talk about is the controversy. This gets more environmentally oriented. Feral cats versus wildlife. This is something I've been spending a lot of time thinking about lately, and this will raise some of the issues about that you've already talked about here, you know, the sort of concern for individuals versus ecosystem concerns. And then finally, if there's time, I'll talk about hunting. In honor of the season, it's hunting season. Hunting season started this week. Anybody who's taken 212 knows I like to deal with cartoons and popular culture. You know, I'm always reminded of Elmer Fudd. It's wabbit season last week. Never too early to start thinking about your term paper topics. Elmer Fudd would be a good one. Also in honor of the season, people will know that from 212 and my other classes, I have a fascination with how values are transmitted culturally. And if I had more time and I thought about it this morning, I'd have scanned the pictures in from this. But I want to do a little reading from a children's book. This is called "Twas the Night Before Thanksgiving." And so you guys, you know, you're going off to Turkey Day next week. And so I want to read this to you. This is a sort of alternative version of what Thanksgiving is. I'll hold the pictures up so you can see it. It's basically about a bunch of kids who go on a field trip to a turkey farm. "'Twas the day before Thanksgiving, and all through the trees, the fall leaves were spinning aloft in the breeze. Eight children had boarded their school bus with grins in hopes that a field trip soon would begin. And you can't see it unless you're in the front row. The teacher's got little peace sign earrings, and she looks very earthy, veggie, and sort of suitably Ithaca-esque. They sang as they rode through autumn terrains while visions of drumsticks danced in their brains. And there they go on their school bus, and there's the drumsticks. This is a great book. I swiped this from my daughter, you know, who... "Over rivers, through woods, with winding and weaves, their school bus sailed on through the new fallen leaves. When out on the road, there arose such a clatter, they threw down their windows to see what was the matter. When what with their wondering eyes should they see but a miniature farm and eight tiny turkey? and a little old man so lively and rugged, they knew in a moment it was Farmer Mac Nugget. And there is Farmer Mac, Mac Nugget. It gets, but wait, there's more. He was dressed all in denim from his head to his toe with a pinch of polyester and a dash of Velcro. And then in a twinkling, they heard in the straw the prancing and pawing of each little claw. Do turkeys have claws? I guess. More rapid than chickens, his cockerels they came. He whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Ollie, now Stanley, now Larry and Moe, on Wally, on Beaver, on Shemp and Groucho. The turkeys were chunky with smiley beaked faces, and they greeted the children with downy embraces. And here's where it gets really precious. So the kids are giving the turkeys hugs. So out through the barnyard they ran and they flew. They gobbled and giggled as friends sometimes do. So the kids are playing with the turkeys. Again, I'll pass this around when I get done. Then somebody spotted an axe by the door, and she asked Farmer Nugget, what was it for? And you got to see the picture of Farmer McNugget and his wife. It's the, okay, it's getting the registered effect up top. With a blink of his eye and a twist of his head, the old farmer told a grim tale of dread. Tonight, said McNugget, these feathery beasts will be chopped up and roasted for Thanksgiving feasts. The children stood still as tears filled their eyes. Then they clamored aloud in a chorus of cries, and the teachers freaked out. So, oh dear, cried McNugget, now what shall I do? So he dashed to the well, and the teacher went too. They fetched some water fresh from the ground in hopes that a swig might calm everyone down. In theatrical terms, that's the deus ex machina to get them out of the scene for what happens next. When they returned to quiet the matter, the children were calmer, but mysteriously fatter. The boys and girls drank up their drinks in the hay. They thanked old McNugget, and then they waddled away. And if you look at the pictures, they've snuck the turkeys under their shirts in an act of ecotage, animal liberation. They limped to the school bus, all huffing and puffing. It's not easy to walk with hot turkey stuffing. And then as the school bus drove off in the night, McNugget looked round. Not a turkey in sight. And there's a real Van Gogh thing going on here in the end of this. You know, you have to sort of, this never too early to start thinking about term paper topics. I mean, just look at the art. I mean, it's just beautiful, right? Starry, starry night. 'Twas the night before Thanksgiving, and the stars up above shone down on a school bus abounding with love. The very next evening, eight families were blessed with eight fluffy Thanksgiving turkeys as guests. They feasted on veggies with jelly and toast, and everyone was thankful. The turkeys were most. So each one gave thanks for love and for living, and they all had a wonderful, happy Thanksgiving. So that's 'Twas the Night Before Thanksgiving, story and pictures by Dave Pelkey, a personal favorite of mine. But truly, there's a serious lecture in here somewhere. All right, let me review. These are going to be terms, hopefully, that will be familiar. You went through the basic approaches to ethical theory. Let me put a couple of 25-cent words back up here. This is by way of review. It's also never too early to start thinking about your final exam. This word should be familiar, right? Deonto what? Deontological approaches to ethics. And then a second big category, ethics. What's another big category, ethics? What is it? Okay, utilitarianism is an example of a broader, what's a broader word? Consequentialism, right. Let me just start with these. Let's just put consequence, be done with it. Deontological approaches to ethics, abstract principles or rules. The Greek root is deontos, meaning duty or obligation. This is the type of ethical approach that says, as a matter of abstract principle, you know, things are right or wrong. So, for example, when it comes to animal rights, there are a lot of people who believe it is wrong to kill an animal. Thou shalt not kill a human being. It is wrong to tell a lie. It is good to tell the truth. These are deontological approaches to ethics. Consequence-based ethics have to do with an evaluation of the final outcome, right? And that determines whether or not an act is considered ethical or not. Utilitarianism is an example of a consequence-based ethic. Peter Singer falls in this tradition. Just to associate this, you should know this. Singer is here. Tom Regan stands in the deontological tradition. The philosopher Kant is a deontologist. Jeremy Bentham, who is one of Singer's inspirations, is a consequentialist. There are other categories of ethics I won't review for you. I don't know how much Dr. Baer has done with this. Sometimes people will refer to contract theories of ethics as well as virtue theories of ethics. And in a lot of ways, religious ethics, which you've spent a lot of time with, are a category of virtue ethics. That's one way of looking at them. But today I want to sort of spend my time here and refer it to these case examples. Now, one of the things I've done professionally is defend the killing of defenseless innocent animals. In the course of my thesis, I defended sport hunting. I didn't grow up hunting. I came to graduate study into Cornell basically sympathetic to animal rights and animal welfare as a philosophy. One of the things that happened along the way studying animal rights as philosophy is I sooner or later came to a conclusion for myself that it didn't seem to hold up as philosophy. And there's a number of elaborate reasons why I think that's true. I'll save some of that for question and answer. And then along the way, I got interested in the hunting topic, which I'll come to. But it surprises some people, and it surprises me. I'm on the board of directors of the Tompkins County SPCA. Now, anybody here volunteer at the SPCA or know anything about it? What's the SPCA's claim to fame these days? Anybody know? Right. What's SPCA stand for? Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Originally, the sort of ultimate parent organization was founded in Britain back in the 1820s. In the United States, these organizations sprung up in the 1860s and 70s, and now they're all over the country. There are local SPCAs, which our shelter is one. There are national organizations that have similar sounding titles, and they're not really linked. There's a national sort of American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And it's also interesting to note that when these organizations were founded over 100 years ago, they weren't just humane associations dedicated to preventing cruelty to animals, but also to children. There were a lot of problems with children being beaten, children, you know, child labor was a huge problem. And so you had these nonprofit organizations that were founded to protect the interests of animals, children, and other people, you know, who couldn't speak for themselves. That's a phrase that you often see in the animal rights literature. Now, in the last 10 years or so, there's been a shift in a philosophy. The traditional philosophy of societies to prevent cruelty to animals has been really a consequentialist-inspired sort of system of ethics. The idea here is to prevent animal suffering and to promote animal well-being. And so here there's an evaluation within this tradition of an animal's quality of life. That's the outcome that you're going to judge whether something is ethical or not. Now, if an animal is too sick or can't be adopted or whatever, traditionally SPCAs have killed animals, albeit by euthanasia. They use the solution. It goes to sleep. It's quite painless. And that has traditionally been considered an acceptable way of dealing with stray pet overpopulation, cats and dogs. In the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a movement away from euthanasia to the so-called no-kill philosophy. And these SPCAs around the country are adopting this as a policy. They don't want to kill any animals. They will go through, you know, just Herculean leaps and bounds to either adopt animals out or try and deal with them in some other way other than putting animals to sleep. Now, this leads to some very interesting sort of problems. I had done, in the course of other research, a sort of mini tour of animal shelters in the Southeast. I was in an animal shelter this past summer in Hilton Head, South Carolina, and I was talking to the director there. This is a humane society that is no kill. They pride themselves on having been no kill for over 10 years. I think they're up to about 14 years. They haven't killed an animal in 14 years. This is really something. But guess what? When you get in the back and look at their cages, they've got animals. There was a dog that had been there 12 years. You know, in about an 8 by 10 cage, you know, basically pacing the floor of this cage. And even though they have a policy of letting their volunteers go in and walk the animals, you know, hopefully once or twice a week, people, you know, who volunteer at shelters, you know, they have their favored animals, and some who are not so favored maybe get skipped once in a while. And in some, and in fact, this is what happens with animals who live out their entire existence. They're not adoptable for whatever reason. They either bite or they're vicious or whatever. And because of a no-kill principle in the abstract that these people hold very dear, you have an animal essentially confined to an 8x10 space for the entire existence, you know, the duration of its life. Now, what do you guys think about that? Just, well, what are the ethical issues here? Yeah. Do you think it's a good thing to have an animal in a cage for that long with no hope of adoption? Really, this is really the issue. A traditional SPCA cannot adopt certain animals because they're just not, they're not socialized.
Well, a lot of SPCA, like Shutdown Mills, or like puppy farms, that the animals are like caged up, or like they're not in the proper condition. But it seems kind of unethical to take an animal away from that and then put them right back in.
And in some cases, this is what happens. You'll have county, you know, a lot of SPCAs get involved in county-level animal control, and they will go in and shut down a puppy mill. That's the phrase that's used. That actually happened in the last 6 months here in Tompkins County. There was a breeder up in the town of Groton who apparently kept her animals in very bad conditions. The SPCA has sort of police authority through their animal control officers to go in and take animals away from situations of cruelty. But then it strikes some people as odd if you're going to simply turn around and basically imprison this animal in sort of solitary confinement. I mean, not to anthropomorphize too much. But there's a range of issues that this tension in philosophy, and this is where the rubber meets the road. This is the real world. It's not just an academic debate between Peter Singer at Princeton and Tom Regan at North Carolina, but this is values playing themselves out in conflict in everyday life. Let me use one other example of a problem we have at the SPCA. I'm on the board, as I said. We have a problem, an ongoing problem, and there's no better way of putting it, with customer service. Our employees, we have a staff of 12, and we've got just an army of volunteers. I hate to say it, but a lot of times you go into the SPCA, and you're not treated very politely. You know, there's almost, in the last 3 or 4 years at the SPCA, an animals first type of ethos that's evolved. And, in fact, people are not very concerned about how they come across to the public. And heaven forbid you come into the SPCA and want to surrender an animal. You know, let's say you have a cat and you're moving and you can't take it to where you're going. Traditionally, SPCAs have been the ones to accept those kinds of animals. This is an ongoing problem. And so you have, in the animal shelter world, what looks like a good move, this move to no-kill, and everybody, I applaud this, because it's a waste, really, to kill these animals just for no other reason than we can't find homes for them. I was in an animal shelter in Alachua County, Florida, where there must have been at least 200 cats. This was the day's harvest, lined up on a loading dock, just dead, and probably 30 or 40 dogs. And it's a grim sight. And all these animals are destined, you know, they get burned. They get cremated. And it's basically because of a lack of funding, a lack of staff, and a lack of imagination of how to do the extra work to place these animals. Note the human benefits of placing animals as well. You're not just saving an animal's life, but people who have pets, you know, that enhances and enriches their life. You know, you could be a completely human-centered, have an ethic that's human-centered, and want to save animal lives as well. But this no-kill principle is at odds with the sort of welfarist tradition that we've inherited in the SPCA, the animal shelter world. That's one case study. We'll leave some questions to the end. What's the next one? Feral cats and wildlife. This dovetails with the welfare concern of trying to enhance animals' lives. In the last 10 or 15 years, and it's no coincidence that a lot of these movements have sprung about subsequent to the publication of Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation. You've read excerpts from that this week. The landmark book that was published in 1975, many people in the animal rights and animal welfare movements consider it the Bible of the animal rights movement, even though there are some significant philosophical tensions between Singer's approach and Regan's approach. But feral cats, one way people are trying to deal with stray and feral cats is to catch them. Some people have heard me lecture on this in other classes, so I apologize if a little of this is redundant. They catch the cats, and while they have them captured, sterilize them, spay or neuter, and then they turn them loose. Now, when I first heard this, coming from a background in environmental ethics, I sort of thought, well, that's kind of nutty. You know, you got these cats in your hands and you're turning them loose. They go munch on, you know, birds and mice and whatnot. And then on the other side, I started, you know, reading the literature, the anti-cat literature that comes out from groups like the American Bird Conservancy. They want every cat in America to be indoors. They got a program called Cats Indoors with an exclamation point. And I heard about that. I thought, well, that's kind of dumb, too. That's technical philosophical term. But, you know, every cat inside. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm allergic to cats. I don't even like cats. And I find myself defending cats. And my wife's got six cats, and I usually try and kick them out the door so I'm not sneezing and wheezing all night. But, you know, there are some cats that are just, they're born to roam. They want to be outside. So here you have a welfare concern coming out of a consequentialist or a welfarist perspective that says, arguably, it's good for cats to be outside at least some of the time. Maybe other cats can be indoors. And you have this abstract principle that it's wrong to kill cats. Right? One of the reasons people want to spay and neuter them and go through all that effort is to avoid euthanizing them at county animal shelters and avoiding the spectacle of 200 cats on a loading dock waiting to be burned. Now, the problem comes up, and this has arisen in several states, with the question about what impact are cats having on native wildlife. Right? You put two and two together. Let's say there's 2 million cats in New York State, and let's say on average they eat one thing a year. They're outside. That's 2 million birds and mice and voles that get munched. And actually, when you look into that literature, the estimates of what cats eat range from one critter a year to one critter a day. You know, every cat in the state of New York eating a critter a day, you know, 365 critters a year, that's a lot of critters being eaten. And so here, now you have a sort of moral dilemma of which animals do you favor? Do you kill the cats to save the birds? Or do you save the cats at the risk of letting the birds get killed? And where's the happy medium? What kind of policy do you arrive at that balances the interests of cat lovers? And there are a lot of cat lovers. These programs are very popular because nobody likes to kill cats. People will show up at a clinic in the afternoon, on a Sunday afternoon, let's say. You'll have 100 volunteers bringing these cats in, and they'll spay or neuter 200 cats in an afternoon. Veterinarians love these programs because no vet likes to put an animal to sleep. It actually violates their professional code of ethics to put an animal to sleep for no good reason other than our convenience. And so they'll show up at these clinics, donate their time for free, and they'll do 200 surgeries in an afternoon. So these are very popular programs. On the other hand, you have wildlife biologists and environmental managers who are screaming and pointing their fingers at the cat and saying, this is the reason for, you know, the decline in certain endangered species. I spent the better part of a week in Florida this summer. I went to Key Largo. Key Largo has been a hotbed of this debate. In Key Largo, there are two federally endangered species, the Key Largo wood rat and the Key Largo cotton mouse. The wood rat is a subspecies of the eastern wood rat. It's so named because it builds a lodge on the ground like a beaver out of sticks. And they live in about a 2 mile by 10 mile swath of National Wildlife Refuge. Now, the only problem is that on Key Largo, there's a very exclusive gated community called the Ocean Reef Club. These are people who like boats and golf and tennis. And, you know, they have two kinds of people, M people and B people. When I visited, we went down the M people's roads. You know, that's where the millionaires live. That's the other side of the tracks. You don't go down the B people's roads. And they support a colony of feral cats that at one time was 3,000 cats. This is on Key Largo. Okay, this is in the neighborhood of the endangered, federally endangered Key Largo wood rat and the Key Largo cottonmouse, and you've got 3,000 cats. Put two and two together, right? You look at that and you say, well, gee, that's a bad place to have cats, right? Because these are also feral cats. They're outside. They've gotten their number down to about 500 in 10 years, after adopting this trap, neuter, and release approach, which, again, doesn't kill, but it sterilizes the animals. And I went down there to see what the hubbub was about, and believe it or not, when I got down there and actually looked at the lay of the land and where these endangered species live and where the cats are and put all the data together, It turns out that these cats at this very exclusive gated oceanside community would have to swim across 2 miles of red mangrove swamp to forage for the last of these 40, you know, Key Largo eastern wood rats. Really, it's just not going to happen. I mean, one of the things about the management of these colonies, and this is what happens in places, you go to Atlantic City, there are cat colonies under the boardwalk, and there are little feeding stations with shelters, and volunteers, you know, sit there and feed them every day. These cats are there in the morning for chow time. They're there in the evening for chow time. They're all named. They all have their shots. And it's very unlikely that they're traveling 2 miles, you know, through a swamp to forage on endangered species. So it's one of these things, if you do a search, never too early or too late to start thinking about term papers. This is a great term paper, right? This is environmental ethics in action. What do you do at Key Largo? To make a long story short, and I have whole presentations on this, one of the thoughts about these mammals that live on the ground, one of the alternative culprits for their decline is the fire ant. Anybody know anything about fire ants? Fire ants in the southeast United States, they're a stinging insect. They really do a major hurt on humans, deer, anything. The theory is that they're driving the wood rat off the ground where they build their lodges, up into the trees where they'll build their nest, and that, you know, lays them open to predation from other critters and all sorts of problems. So a lot of times, trying to figure out what's happening empirically, you know, on the ground, so to speak, will affect your ethical and your sort of political judgments about what's appropriate to do in a certain situation. Using the Key Largo example, arguably, it's a good thing that they've gotten the number of cats to drop from 3,000 cats to 500 cats. And they've done it on their own dime, you know, and not at the public, you know, at the public's cost. So the feral cat wildlife issue is also very complicated, and a side issue there is the aesthetic question of what kind of animal do you want to value. You know, if you're a cat lover, you're going to privilege cats. If you're a wildlife lover, you're going to privilege wildlife. And this gets back to some of Dr. Baer's themes throughout the whole semester. How do you make decisions in a pluralistic society? Right? We have a plurality of values. They all compete. And no value, in this case at least, intuitively or easily trumps the other. It's hard to say, you know, whose value system should win out in this case. I'll leave some more for discussion. The last case study is the hunting example. Again, like I said, I didn't grow up hunting. I found myself defending it philosophically in the course of my dissertation research. And it presents us with a moral problem. How is it that we can defend the killing of animals seemingly for human pleasure, right? A lot of people think that's a fairly trivial use or exploitation of an animal. This is on a par with wearing furs or you know, think of your favorite frivolous use of an animal that could be avoided. And yet, the more I thought about hunting, and along the way I got into the various literatures on various blood sports. Anybody want to ask me questions about bullfighting or cockfighting or, you know, there's some interesting parallels to other activities. But I came to a conclusion ultimately that could be boiled down to a consequence-based type of judgment, that it's the benefits of hunting that accrue to the hunter that outweighs the interest of the animal in living. And interest here used in a very technical sort of philosophical term. It's not to say that an animal psychologically takes an interest in his or her own life. That's a very different thing. Now, what do you guys think about hunting? Let me just open this up to a little bit of discussion. Let's see where people are on hunting. Is hunting good, bad, you know, evil?
Really necessary.
For management, you mean?
Huge issue for, you know, anyone who's trying to do any sort of
right. Well, one of the problems with those types of, and not to just jump on it and say there's a problem, but, you know, if management's your concern, you can just as easily justify management actions by the use of poison. Right? There's no reason to use volunteer hunters who have the risk of wounding something and have it crippled and wander off, you know, die in horrible agony off in a ditch somewhere. So there are more efficient ways to manage for problems, right, whether it's sharpshooters or poison or whatever. I'm really more concerned with sport hunting, recreational or volunteer hunting that people do, you know, out of choice. How does that strike people? Yeah.
I think for those people who are going to eat meat fish and definitely have to see their own stuff and die, not to be able to get a slab of beef on a plate and eat that and be completely unstressed.
So there's some value to seeing it up close rather than being detached from it.
Right.
Okay, if they're going to do it at all.
Yeah, if they're not
going to
do it.
Okay. It was a, yep. Great question. What's the point of hunting? Why do people hunt? Let's ask that to everyone. Even if you don't hunt, why do you think people hunt? That's very important. It gets at the question of motivation. And motivation is very important. Right? Hunting done casually offends even the most committed diehard hunter. You know, it's not, and also hunting is not just blasting a bazooka at a cow over a barbed wire fence, right? I mean, you know, that's the other thing. You know, sometimes you get these people with, you know, certain ideas about what hunting is. It's performed a certain way. It's a very ritualistic sort of activity. You know, there's a whole literature on the right way and the wrong way to do it. Why do you think people hunt? Is it an important enough thing to people to justify killing animals? Yeah. Kind of like a bad habit. I mean, you just do it. I mean, you know. I have a fairly irreverent sense of humor. I'm not picking on you, but you can hunt alone. I mean, it's not just being out with the guys. That's you know, also sometimes used in justification of hunting. And yet there are other ways to establish fraternity and camaraderie with one's fellows. Right? Join the Rotary. Yeah. But then why not just walk in the woods? You know, the Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset wrote probably the best book on hunting ethics. It's a little book called Meditations on Hunting. And he asked the question in that book, why not just take a camera? Why do you have to kill? I mean, if you, you know, why not take a camera, and if you want to get really serious about it, paint, you know, get a lens with crosshairs on it so that when you develop it, you're like, aha, I hit the kill zone, I'm yeehaw. Or paintball. You know, you could do paintball, red, you know, do the whole effect, you know, splat, you know, and you just got the red and the gore and, you know, all the thrill that goes with it. Would that work? Could you do paintball or photography? Why is the kill necessary? Is the food the primary reason for hunting? I mean, there are easier ways to get food, right? You can go down to Wegmans and get a rack of venison, actually, and not have to spend all that time in the rain and the snow. And plus, there's other critters that food is less of a justification, right? I mean, nobody really goes out to hunt, you know, the pesky woodcock, you know, to fill the freezer. The woodcock is a bird. It's about the size of a quail. You get about a half an ounce of meat off of it, you know. You have to kill an awful lot of woodcock to make a meal. But I think you're right, right? Food is an important part, but is food more of a byproduct of the activity, right? And a way of signifying the importance of the life that you've taken. I mean, this gets fairly involved. That I would make that argument sort of in response. Other reasons why people hunt?
Well, male species or male, you know, members of any species are actually more aggressive than female, like, and that.
Hunting is an act of aggression, you think, or violence?
It's a more accepted way to get out aggression, and it's a social aspect and the food aspect, and there's a lot of benefits besides just the being aggressive or having a fight with something in nature or something.
I'm going to defer the aggression thing. Let me go to a Dom. Yeah. Checks in the mail. It's a good thing I planted him. I mean, this is really the question. All right. I mean, Why is the death necessary? This is what Ortega asked in his book, and this is the moral question that every thoughtful or reflective hunter, and I'm not saying every hunter is thoughtful. You know, there are a lot of people, like I said, who take it way too casually, and I don't think they should be in the woods or on the swamps or whatever either. Let me try out an argument on you guys and see what you think, and then, you know, I'll probably leave it at that. Well, one of the things that I started reading in the course of doing my dissertation research was the philosophical literature on tragedy. Tragedy as a cultural phenomenon has sort of perplexed philosophers for well over 2,000 years. Going back to Aristotle and Plato, philosophers have wondered, isn't it a little weird that we humans derive pleasure from the depiction of pain and suffering of others? You know, either dramatically on a stage or sometimes in real life. Plato in the Republic talks about a guy named Leontius who's walking outside the city walls of Athens, and this is where they would dump the bodies of the paupers, dead soldiers from the Peloponnesian Wars or whatever. And Leontius is trying to shade his eyes from this, you know, they're stacked like cordwood. And Plato recounts this in the Republic. He says Leontius has this internal struggle. He wants to look. He desperately wants to look at the bodies, but he's a little repulsed that he has this longing. He's puzzled by this, and it's a real internal struggle. And he finally looks. He caves in, and he says, "Behold, there was the glorious spectacle." And Plato wonders about this. He says, "You know, what is it in human nature that makes us? Why do we have this rather macabre fascination with death?" And think about it. I mean, it's like rubbernecking on a highway. Right? There's a big crash. Everybody slows down. Everybody wants to look. Go ahead, admit it. Right? And, you know, I think that this offers a parallel to the fascination with death and hunting, and partly offers a reason why the death is necessary in hunting. Even though there are people who can hunt for 10 or 15 years, you know, they're going for Moby Buck, you know, the big trophy buck that, you know, and they don't kill anything for 10 or 15 years, they've still hunted as long as the very real possibility of the kill was there all along. I mean, otherwise it's just sitting in the woods, right, or taking a walk in the woods. And to me, I think this fascination with death that we also see expressed culturally in the experience of tragedy, I think there's close parallels there. Now, I always face this, the inevitable student objection is, well, wait a minute, tragedy is just fiction. You know, that's just acting it out on a stage, and hunting is real life. You're really killing an animal, and somebody's really suffering. And what I tend to remind people is think about movies, historical films especially, things like the movie Schindler's List, you know, that was about the Holocaust. I mean, you watch this movie, this happened to real people. And on one level, we in the audience, we are entertained, right? And at the same time, we're a bit horrified by what we're seeing. You know, there's a feeling of ambivalence about going to a movie like Schindler's List. And this is what tragic theorists have paid attention to for thousands of years. They say that ambivalence is the root of the tragic experience. There's a feeling of attraction and repulsion. And that's partly the power that tragedy has. And I think hunting is a lot like that. I think most hunters, when they think about that moment of the kill, there's a sort of moment of, yee-haw, I did it. You know, I was successful. All these long hours have come to fruition. And then the very next instant, there's a feeling of sadness, right, or a bittersweet tinge of remorse. There was a well-known Victorian print I encountered when I was doing my research, and it showed a bird hunter, you know, in Victorian hunting togs, and he had his gun cracked open, a little wisp of smoke coming out of the breech, holding a bird. His dog is at his feet, and he's looking at it kind of weird. And the caption is simply, "The moment of regret." And I think that really captures this feeling of ambivalence that a lot, if not most, hunters feel at the moment of the kill. There's a sense of gladness for having done something well, especially if you killed the animal with no pain, right? The hunter's ideal is that of the clean, quick kill, right? A single shot, the animal hopefully falls over, and it never knows what hit it. That's the ideal. Now, obviously, hunting, you know, you don't always put the ideal into practice, but at least that's a moral value that hunters share in strange ways with the rest of the population. This is itself a welfarist concern. Category number two, consequence-based ethics. Hunters themselves have a welfare orientation. Even though they hunt, they take life, they are concerned to minimize suffering to the extent possible. And that strikes people as sort of paradoxical and sort of perverse. But that perversity, you know, I would argue is actually something philosophers have acknowledged and paid attention to going back to their analysis of Greek tragic drama, you know, 2,500 years ago. So I would argue there are these larger things that, you know, at play. And I won't maybe go so far to say it's human nature, but certainly in the human makeup there is something that's attractive about the hunt that is akin to tragic drama. The one other thing I would add is the line from Alfred North Whitehead, and then I'll leave it for the last 5 minutes for discussion. Alfred North Whitehead is a philosopher who wrote a book called Science and Process and Reality is where this quote is from. He said, life is robbery. Life is robbery. And what he meant is that life exists at the expense of life. To live, you have to kill, whether it's pulling carrots out of your garden or whether it's pulling the trigger on your gun or releasing the arrow. And even the diehard, you know, militant vegetarian lives at the expense of other life. An example I use is the tilling of the ground for crops. You know, you have a field of soybeans. Soybeans were big in our neighborhood this year. And that very act of breaking the ground takes life. I had this hammered home several years ago. We put in a new septic system, my favorite anecdote. Six trenches in a field, a fallow field that we have, probably 200 feet worth of pipe. And when they filled it all in, I went out and walked just to look around, and I was astounded by the number of dead star-nosed moles that were out there on the top of the soil, just belly up. And just that act of breaking the soil takes life. And so I think people who eat tofu or, you know, rely on soybeans for everything, you know, they are just as guilty in a sense of taking life. There may be less awareness. And this gets back to that issue of, you know, going to the store and getting your meat shrink-wrapped and not thinking about it. The hunter can at least sort of take ownership or responsibility for the death he or she causes. I mean, that's a conscious decision at the time of attempting to make the kill. So the hunting question, all these questions are very complex. You know, that's the thing. I mean, you could spend hours on any one of these issues and tease out sort of the network of considerations that are at play, moral considerations, aesthetic considerations, in any of these case examples. Ethics is not often very clean. It's often quite gray and quite fuzzy. That's sometimes the source of enormous confusion and resentment among students who take their first philosophy course. And, you know, there's been a complaint for 2,500 years that philosophers always ask questions, they just never answer them. You know, and sometimes I feel like that as well. But in the last 5 minutes, let's open it up to discussion and see where it takes us. Yes, down here.
When you first proposed the utilitarian weighing of the hunter's benefit versus the animal's
right. Right. Let me use an example. This is another plant. Let me read a passage from an essay that Peter Singer wrote. This is the more didactic portion of the lecture. In the book Animal Liberation, he never talks about the rightness or the wrongness of killing animals. Right? I don't know if you've seen the pictures from the book. You know, the eye drops they put in the rabbit's eyes and the pictures of the battery chickens in these very cramped cages. But he never talks about the ethics of killing an animal. Singer, in a later essay, which is called Killing Humans and Killing Animals, takes up the question of whether or not it's appropriate to kill animals. And he basically makes the argument that this question hinges on the presence or absence of animal self-awareness, right? Self-consciousness. Does the animal know what's going on? Are animals little people? Right, think of us being hunted. If we were being hunted, we would know. We'd be like the pheasant in Bambi. Ah, I can't take it anymore. But presumably, animals may not have that quality of self-awareness, right? I mean, otherwise we'd be moral monsters every time we walked in the woods, right? If you flush up a flock of chickadees and they're all screaming in terror, we should stay out of the woods, shouldn't we? But, you know, in behaviorist terms, a lot of biologists figure these are either flight or fright reflexes. Anyway, Singer says, let me just read this. So far as animals are concerned, and this is from that essay, Killing Humans and Killing Animals. This is from 1979. So far as animals are concerned, it obviously becomes important to try to decide which animals are self-conscious in the sense of being capable of desiring to go on living. Some philosophers have argued that only a language user can be self-conscious, and this, as an aside, is an enormously complicated area of philosophy. Get back to me later. Singer says, he continues, I do not find these arguments convincing, but the issue is too large to be considered here. He's a smart guy. He says, in any case, I would be prepared to concede that some of the animals commonly killed for food are not self-conscious. Chickens could be an example. End of quote. Now note what Singer is saying here. Right? As long as you're killing that chicken painlessly, that may be morally acceptable. The benefit to humans of having that food source outweighs whatever biological interest there is in that chicken continuing to live, as long as you do it painlessly. You know, Singer's basically arguing here that for birds, let's say, the lights are on, nobody's home. Right? He would not say this for beef cattle. This is a drawing the line issue, and different people draw that line in different places. Peter Singer would not presumably say this about beef cattle. Other people would argue that fish have consciousness and are aware, and this is why they struggle on the hook. Another good term paper topic. So that's a complicated question. But I am very sympathetic to this question of trying to determine, you know, the extent to which what's going on in the animal's head affects the moral question of what's okay to do to it. And this goes back to Bentham. In the section that you read of Peter Singer, you know, he probably quotes Bentham. Do you have that little section in where he says the question is not can they reason, can they talk, but can they suffer? Right? That's Bentham who says that. If that's a little mini essay on your final exam, but can they suffer, you can thank me for knowing that it was Bentham, because I'm drawing your attention to it right now. But the question of animal suffering is enormously complicated. It's not really a sure thing. A lot of people simply assume the animal is shot, and ergo it suffers. But a lot of times when people are shot, they don't even feel it. You know, Ronald Reagan, the president of the United States, he wasn't too, you know, the sharpest knife in the drawer, but, you know, he gets in the limo and somebody says, your shirt's red. Oh, yeah, I must be shot. And this is a common enough reported instance of the reaction to a gunshot wound. It may just be that a deer shot doesn't feel anything. Right? This makes sense in evolutionary terms, right? Pain is an adaptively advantageous adaptation that kicks in later to help with convalescence, right? It wouldn't be evolutionarily a good strategy to feel pain instantly, right? What's evolutionary advantageous is to get away from the source of the pain-causing agent as fast as you can. And this is a question, you know, with hunting. You know, a lot of times people simply assume the animal that is shot suffers. It may be that the animal falls over instantly. It may be that the animal is shot a second time 5 minutes later and never actually, you know, this is going to sound weird, does not experience suffering and may not feel pain. There's a whole literature in the biomedical ethics literature about something called stress-induced analgesia. There's a two-cent word for you. Analgesia, literally the absence of pain. And it refers to this phenomenon that when the body undergoes traumatic injury, you know, opiate-like compounds in the brain kick in, and maybe the psychological experience the animal is experiencing is something we can't know. And I'm not saying that proves anything. I want to be very careful. Here's the caveat. I'm not saying, oh, go out and shoot, you know, everything in sight now, because, you know, that's a license to kill. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm just saying that the question of what happens on the receiving end is very complicated, and it's not as easy as Bentham makes it out to be, can they suffer? You know, I don't think we know that. Okay, I'm done. Good night.